Iku Iluna, please rise. Ohea oko eko ka aha, inahe kuleana imua o kea aha ho o kolo kolo ki eke hana hana o kumoko aina o Hawaii. E nai mai, e malio mai, I lohi I e ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E nolo I lalo, please be seated.
Velina? Makamoku puni o Oahu I kamoku o kona I ano ka koma ali o Lanihale. Greetings on the island of Oahu in the district of Kona. We are gathered here at ali o Lanihale. Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-22-0000362. Lester Samara, respondent plaintiff appellant versus Stephen Gu, individually and in his official capacity as operations manager, supervisor, and safety manager, petitioner defendant appellee, and Royal Hawaiian Movers defendant appellee, and Glenn Salvador defendant. Arguing for the petitioner, Stephen Gu, Mark Valencia, also appearing is Alana Johnson. Arguing for the respondent, Lester Sumera, Alex Sonson, argument on the merits.
Aloha kakahiaka, good morning. Today's proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. And I'd like to welcome our substitute justice in this case, Judge Catherine Remigio. Thank you for being here. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
Thank you. The court has allowed 30 minutes for each side. And to confirm, Mr. Valencia, you intend to argue for 20 minutes and reserve 10 minutes for a rebuttal. And Mr. Sonson, you will have 30 minutes with a 10-minute warning. Mr. Valencia, please proceed.
May it please the court, Mark Valencia and Alana Johnson for petitioner Stephen Gu. Thank you very much for agreeing to take this case. Two issues for the court to decide that are related, one dependent, I think, on the other. And the first is the appropriate burden of proof that a trial court should use during summary judgment proceedings. And the second is whether or not applying that appropriate burden of proof, the circuit court or the ICA got it right in this case. And, you know, I when I was looking at this issue regarding the first issue, the burden of proof, the ICA mentioned in a footnote that the circuit court used the incorrect burden of proof, citing Bremer. And I was sort of surprised because I had honestly never researched that issue. I don't fault the ICA for citing the Bremer decision because that, as of now, is good law. And it, as I was preparing for today, it reminded me of the late Jim Branham, who was a longtime Hawaii Supreme Court staff attorney. In 1996, when I was clerking for Judge Kirimitsu at the ICA, he gave us an orientation and he said, if you want to have a cert blocker for your opinions at the ICA, cite Hawaii Supreme Court cases. Those are cert blockers, he called them. So I think that's what the ICA did here. They did the right thing in that regard. So during the proceedings in front of the circuit court, when the circuit court was asking the question, where is your clear and convincing evidence to support this claim? It didn't trigger anything in me that was an incorrect question because the burden of proof for the claim we're going to talk about is clear and convincing. So when I saw that footnote, I go and I read the Bremer decision. The Bremer decision does say what the ICA says it does, but there's no analysis. It just says that the circuit court in that case, Judge Ibarra, used an incorrect standard, clear and convincing evidence, when trying to decide who owned a trail where the underlying burden of proof was required proof by clear and convincing evidence. And then Bremer cites another decision and support. So I go look at that other decision, and all it says is you decide cases in summary judgment based on whether or not there's a genuine issue of material fact. Okay, right? So I went deeper, and I found just an entire body of case law, starting with the U.S. Supreme Court and multiple state Supreme Courts from around the country, where they say that when the underlying claim has a certain burden of proof, including clear and convincing evidence, you apply that burden of proof during the summary judgment phase when you're deciding whether or not there are genuine issues of material fact.
I apologize for interrupting, yes. But what about just starting with the rule, Rule 56? We don't have any burden of proof or standard of proof engrafted into that rule. So shouldn't we just go with the plain language? It's just genuine issue of material fact. That's it. What's your response to that?
Yes, Justice. So I think the trial court is always exercising a gatekeeper role during summary judgment proceedings, and it depends on the claim. So when someone brings a claim to determine whether or not there's a genuine issue of material fact, you are looking at the evidence, the quality of the evidence. The judge is deciding whether or not this is sufficient. Is it admissible? Is it hearsay? So I don't think that...
Well, that's just going to the admission of the evidence, not to the burden of proof. And if you go back to the Richards case, the burden of proof is out. That's not a consideration, because doesn't that get into fact-finding, the weighing of the evidence, and that's for the jury? Don't we start encroaching into that area?
In a way, yes, but the way that I look at this is similar to one of the claims that's now out of this case, intentional infliction of emotional distress, where you have to prove that claim, you have to prove that there was an outrageous act beyond all bounds of decency. And your decisions say that's usually a fact question, but the question of whether or not a claim is outrageous is for the court in the first instance. So as a gatekeeper, the court determines whether or not a jury would find that evidence or could find that evidence to be outrageous. And I think you apply sort of the same concept here.
It seems like the same concept is different. You're forcing the judge to make factual decisions, factual findings, aren't you? And is that the right way to go on a Rule 56 matter?
Well, Justice, I think just following up on the point I just made, if the answer to that is yes, then you've got to change your entire body of case law regarding intentional infliction of emotional distress and giving the court the first pass on whether or not a jury would find that evidence to be sufficient to be outrageous. I think you're doing the same thing here, where you have a claim that has a certain burden of proof. It's the same gatekeeper function.
Didn't we in Guib, and I know it was a judgment of matter of law before it was going to the jury, but we basically clearly said that we don't want judges making factual findings. These are for the jury. That was a situation with clear and convincing evidence, much like you have here with regard to punitive damages. Isn't that a very similar situation in the sense that we don't want our judges at certain stages to qualitatively assess the caliber of facts?
I think you're saying two different things, Justice. You're talking about fact finding and weighing evidence. Those are, I think, slightly different. So I agree with you that a judge should not, in a jury case, be making factual findings unless it's an equitable claim. But weighing evidence is something the judge always does. That's part of the summary judgment process. And so I think if you're going to rule on this issue, you should clarify the issues that you're talking about now, the questions that you're asking me. Be specific that when the judge is applying a certain burden of proof, that they're not to be making factual findings to take that issue away from the jury. That's not what this is designed to do. It's designed to perform, the gatekeeper role to determine whether or not this evidence...
You keep referring to this gatekeeper role. When has this court referred to a court's role as a gatekeeper as to whether summary judgment should be granted? I'm kind of confused. Gatekeeper, that's in the context of expert opinions, and I don't see any case law in which we say the court is to serve as a gatekeeper in summary judgment motions.
I think it's similar to evaluating evidence. So when you are deciding a summary judgment motion and someone provides evidence, at the trial court level and even here because it's de novo review, you have to go through a series of steps. You don't just accept what parties present to you. Is it hearsay? Does it lack foundation? You go through the evidentiary rules.
That goes to admissibility, though, not weight. It's just what evidence can genuinely be considered at the summary judgment level to draw reasonable inferences, right. But that doesn't seem to implicate weighing.
Well, I was responding to the issue of gatekeeper. So I think that in the gatekeeper role, and that's maybe a me thing, I use that term a lot, but I think the judges do play an important role in safeguarding the integrity of the proceedings. So I personally don't see a problem with adopting the standard where you are basically requiring the circuit court to evaluate the evidence under a certain burden of proof and determine whether a juror could or could not find that to be clear and convincing.
I understand that argument, but the problem raised on the other side or the counter to that is that you are invading the province of the jury, and you can't do that.
Justice, I don't think it does because, for example, I think invading the province of the jury would be making a credibility determination, for example.
Yeah, but if the court weighs the evidence and grants a summary judgment, the case is gone. The jury's never going to see it.
Correct. And they shouldn't, just like in the case of whether or not a comment or an act could be considered outrageous for purposes of intentional infliction of emotional distress. It's the same analysis. The court is taking that away.
It seems to me that your position that the court should take a gatekeeping role to determine whether or not a reasonable jury could determine by clear and convincing evidence a certain fact or a certain standard is really transposing the federal plausibility standard to the summary judgment context. In other words, is this a plausible claim? And this court has specifically rejected plausibility in pleadings, right? It seems to me that what you're trying to do is say, have the court determine whether or not the claim is plausible in a summary judgment context. How would you respond to that?
I think that's what you always do in summary judgment. So when you are determining—
It's not plausible. It's no, whether or not there's a genuine
correct.
Issue of material fact. And is it a genuine issue of material fact? Right?
I agree. I wasn't suggesting that plausibility is what you always do. I was suggesting that weighing the evidence and determining whether or not—
We don't weigh the evidence.
Well, you do in terms of the burden of production and persuasion and the burden shifting and whatnot in summary judgment. But what you do, you evaluate the evidence. You have to determine whether or not there's a genuine issue of material fact based on evidence, you have to evaluate the evidence. So if the evidence—
All you have to do is look for reasonable inferences and that's it. Game over. Case goes to the jury.
Reasonable inferences based on evidence. And that evidence has to be evaluated under a certain standard. What's that standard going to be? That's where we're coming from on this issue. And I think that's where, you know, your sister Supreme Courts around the country and the U.S. Supreme Court have all come, not all
well,
of them,
but when you're talking about courts around the country, you're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, and you're referring to the Anderson case, probably, I think you're probably referring to courts around the country, Rodriguez, Beamers, things like that. Those are actual malice, defamation, First Amendment cases. Isn't that unique distinction where those cases land? In other words, I think what you're trying to do is suggest through those cases, and they are First Amendment cases for the most part, that we adopt that narrow, let's say, constitutional safeguard for First Amendment cases to, in this particular case, a workplace occupational situation.
Justice, I don't believe that all, and I know that all of those cases do not involve defamation. When I was doing the research, I did, that's the majority of cases that I found, including one of your cases here, did involve defamation. But one of the cases we cited in our application that applied a clear and convincing evidence standard during the summary judgment phase involved a petition for harassment, where the claim has to be proven by clear and convincing evidence. You applied that standard during the summary judgment phase. So really what we're asking you to do is not anything differently than you've already done. And I think based on the cases that we've cited, at a minimum, you have to clarify Bremer, because Bremer does conflict with two of your other decisions where that clear and convincing evidence standard was applied both in the one of them involved defamation, and one of the cases did not. So it's not a rule that's exclusively First Amendment or defamation related. It's based on the underlying claim and the burden of proof for that underlying claim.
Counsel, to adopt your position, would we have to overrule Bremer?
I was thinking about that. I don't see how you don't. I mean, it's a clarification, but in a sense, you have to overrule it because the clear language from Bremer in that one sentence or two says you should not apply a clear and convincing evidence standard during the summary judgment phase. So I think that's just an incorrect statement of the law, if you agree with our position.
Valencia, sorry. So yeah, in Rodriguez and Beamer, which are the malice cases, okay, where this court did in fact apply and consider the higher burden of proof that the plaintiff had at trial, in my view, that directly conflicts with the Beamer analysis and the application there. And actually, you're right. I mean, there really wasn't much analysis in Beamer. I'm more curious and want to point you to Ralston versus Yim, which is a much more recent case by this court, where as part of the test laid out there, this court said where the non-movement bears the burden of proof at trial, which was the case here, right? The
yes.
Non-movement was the plaintiff. It says that one of the ways that the movement can demonstrate there's no genuine issue of material fact is by demonstrating that the non-movement will be unable to carry his or her burden of proof at trial. And then it goes on to discuss Celotex, which is the United States Supreme Court premier case on summary judgment, which this court applied. I mean, rather than just looking at defamation cases, I mean, doesn't our Ralston decision already lay the foundation for what you're arguing? And I'm not sure, I haven't heard you argue Ralston yet.
I didn't, but I agree with you, especially the part that says that that mentions the burden of proof at trial. So then the question is, what is that burden of proof? It could be preponderance, or it could be clear and convincing. It's typically one of those two in civil cases, right? So I think that framework is there, but the existing case law definitely should be clarified to tie all of this together, and that would, I think, include overruling Bremer.
So you wouldn't disagree with me. We still, any trial court, and this court de novo, has to consider all of the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. So here, Mr. Sumera, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And I mean, even if we were to consider the higher standard, the question would be, looking at all that evidence in the view most favorable to Mr. Sumera, whether he could make a clear and convincing case to carry his burden of proof at trial, right? I mean, I'm not sure where this weighing comes in. Isn't it simply looking at whatever evidence is most favorable to him and whether that reaches the level of clear and convincing here, as a similar to your outrageous argument for IIED?
I agree with everything you said, and maybe, you know, weighing is not the most precise word for me to use, but the court is looking at evidence to determine whether or not there's a genuine issue of material fact in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, and whether or not a jury could find that evidence to be persuasive based on the applicable burden of proof. I think that's what you said. That's what I'm saying as well. Maybe not as articulately as you did, but I agree. That's the analysis.
And here, why is there not a genuine issue of material fact? Getting to point number two.
Two reasons. One is the ICA applied the incorrect burden of proof. So I think if the burden of proof for the claim is clear and convincing, the circuit court asked the right question, like, where is your clear and convincing evidence here? So you have 386 so let me just back up and say, this workers' comp system is designed to provide clarity and remedies for employees against the employer and cut down on lawsuits between employers and employees and co-employees. So in this case, that's what happened. Mr. Sumera was seriously injured. He was on workers' comp for many years. The statute was told, that's why we're here 17 years later, because he was on workers' comp for so long, filed his complaint in 2017, so here we are. But that there's a narrow exception for willful and wanton misconduct, which must be proven by clear and convincing evidence. And the test that you established is that there must be a known peril. There must be an injury that is probable, not just possible, and the affected employee must have consciously disregarded that risk. So when you apply that standard and look at the evidence here, I don't think it's even close. So you have these delivery of the trash cans that we all have. 300,000 deliveries, no incident. So that's
no accidents,
no incident, nobody fell off the truck, okay?
Well, maybe you got lucky 300,000 times. Doesn't mean it was safe.
That arguably, yes, could have been luck, but also that goes to the issue of whether or not an injury is probable as opposed to possible. And I think what they're doing is trying to create basically a general negligence standard. So if you're looking at whether they got lucky or whether there's a standard of care, well, they don't have a standard of care expert, but say there's a standard of care that says you got to have railings on this truck. That's a general negligence standard. That's not the specific test that you adopted in Iddings. And in Iddings, you had multiple incidents of prior accidents. You had warnings. You don't have that here. So the quantum of evidence that the trial court looked at here didn't meet that clear and convincing evidence for the exception in 386.
The probability of injury or the probability of a person falling over?
It would be Well, first you start with the known risk. So what's the known risk?
Right.
Probability of that known risk happening, and then conscious disregard of that known risk. So if the known risk is falling over, yes.
The known risk, probability of the known risk.
Yes.
Okay. So let's say that, in a high-rise construction site, general contractor who has an obligation to place like guardrails where people are working up there doesn't place them, and for many years nobody falls, but then somebody does fall because maybe they had a stroke or something and they fall and they die, right? So in that situation, that would not be willful and wanton because it had not happened before? That's your argument.
In a way, I mean, if we're applying the standard and the facts that you relied on in Iddings, where there are multiple instances.
So it's like you get the first bite,
Well,
it's okay if the first person dies
because
it didn't happen before.
No, Justice. I don't think that's. I wouldn't take that position. So I think it depends. It's facts specific. So you don't get necessarily a freebie. It depends on the specific facts of the case.
Because something could be inherently dangerous and just nothing has happened yet, but it's inherently unsafe. You could have those situations.
I agree. You could. And I mean, that's what they've argued here. But my position is what they're arguing is for a general standard to be applied, a general negligence standard. That's possible injury, not probable injury based on the facts of this case. And I think that just wipes out the exception if you do that.
Probable injury, if you fall, the injury is probable.
The injury is probable if they fall. I would agree with that. Yes,
and
depending on how fast you're going.
And isn't it a probable result of an inherently dangerous project for the worker to fall in this particular situation when you're saying it's fact specific?
And I think I would say no, Justice, because the specific facts here are 300,000 deliveries.
Okay, I know, but this success rate thing that, as Justice Devens pointed out, I mean, it strikes me as, well, there might be a situation. Here's an example. Let's say you have a bungee jumping operation, and one employer, the manager, says, you know what, let's save 10% and let's have thinner cords. And, we have 25,000 successful jumps. The co-employee gets up there because they got to test it every morning. And that 25,001 jump, the employer dies. Now, under your idea about success rate, there would really be no protection for that employee who fell because, hey, look, it worked 25,000 other times, right?
No, Justice, they would have a claim under workers' comp with their employer.
I'm talking about going against the manager who decided that he's going to cut cost 10% by getting the thinner cord.
So under your...
That guy's off the hook then, right? No suit against him. MSJ stage, he's out.
Maybe. I mean, I think it would depend. So I think in a case like that, where you're calling something inherently dangerous, I think you need expert testimony about standard of care. We don't have that here. All we have is legal arguments saying, as they put it...
Okay, yeah, I understand, but I guess my... What I'm getting at, and I think what others were here, is this idea about 300,000 bins and success rate. I have issues with that, and if you can just sort of try to explain how, you know, it just because something's never happened before in an inherently dangerous work environment, let's say, or environment as a whole in a normal tort, how that would shield the defendant, in this case a co-employee?
I think for a couple of reasons. One is, like I mentioned earlier, all of the cases that I've looked at here in Hawaii that found an issue of fact and sent this to a jury involved prior warnings, prior incidents. So I think you can't ignore that. I think that's part of the case law. The other is the specific facts of this case. He was not injured because of the lack of guardrails necessarily. The facts of this case are they were basically done. He gets on the truck, the back of the flatbed truck. The driver doesn't know he's there, and the driver takes off. And so they had to, one of the things the ICA relied on, for example, was this testimony of a hypothetical question counsel asked Mr. Gu is, well, if somebody drives erratically and speeds up and slams on the brake, would someone get injured? And Mr. Gu was like, yeah, but the drivers are told not to be speeding. That's not what happened here. He got on the back of the truck and the driver didn't know. So I think in the specific facts of this case, I keep mentioning the 300,000 deliveries because I think if someone had fallen off the truck once, this is a different discussion. Twice, three times, we're not here. Okay?
Basically, you are asking for a freebie. You're asking for a freebie because the willful and wanton misconduct is the circumstances show that the employer has knowledge of the peril to be apprehended, has knowledge that the injury is probable as opposed to possible as a result of the danger, and consciously fails to avoid the peril.
Right.
How is there not a genuine issue of material fact with respect to that?
Because there's no evidence to show that. So if you're, and Judge Justice, if you
when you don't have rails and you have people that are going into the truck, right?
Right.
You have workers that are going to be climbing into the truck. Mm-hmm. How is it not pretty clear that this could be willful and wanton misconduct under the circumstances of this case?
Because I think what you're doing is applying a general negligence standard. That you're what I think what you're saying, in my view, is you have to you're looking at it as risk instead of probability. And you're, I think, essentially talking about possibility.
It's the injury is probable. The injury is right. Probable, not that the risk is probable.
Right.
The injury is probable. If the risk happens, the injury is probable, right?
Right?
Now, you know, maybe it's the injury is not that probable if it's falling off of a, you know, 6-inch thing, right? But falling off of a truck, whether or not it's moving, and whether or not you fall because the truck starts moving or because you have a stroke as you're on the back of the truck, the injury is probable.
Right. So then who is responsible? It's the employer, which the employee here got what he was entitled to under the workers' comp statute against the employer. So now we're talking about a coworker who was not even the supervisor that day. He didn't even assign him to this. And I think you need to look at the specific evidence.
That's not the issue before us. The issue before us, whether or not there's a genuine issue of material fact as to these factors and whether or not we are supposed to review it under clear and convincing evidence. But it seems to me that even if we do review it under clear and convincing evidence here, there would still be a genuine issue of material fact as to whether or not a reasonable person could find this to be willful and wanton misconduct. And as Justice Devens has said, it could depend on the jury. It could depend on the jury. Maybe you have a jury of 12 workers that do this type of work. You know, it seems to me there's questions of fact here.
I think it depends on whether you're talking about a general standard or specifically Mr. Gu, because you have to tie this test to him specifically and look at the evidence related to him specifically. So what's the evidence that he knew about the peril, that it was probable, and consciously disregarded it? The only evidence they provided you with is a hypothetical question to him about whether someone could get hurt if there was erratic driving. That's not enough. I mean, if you're talking about a preponderance, or as one judge told me many years ago, 50% plus a feather, okay. General negligence, okay. Standard of care, okay. But the three-part test in Eddings, it's just not enough as it relates to Mr. Gu. So the evidence that they provided here is not sufficient, unless you are just looking at a broader standard and going to essentially change the law.
What about if the just allowing this practice of having workers sitting on the back that way, and my guess that it saves time and they can do their job faster and get to the end of the day a lot quicker that way, instead of riding in the cab of the truck and then jumping out at each stop, that would seem to be safer. But what about just that practice of allowing the workers to be on the back that way? Isn't that inherently dangerous? And you never know, you can unforeseen, something comes in front of the truck, sudden stop, hits a pothole, driver didn't see it. There's all kinds of scenarios.
I think, Justice, if the driver is driving safely, as Mr. Gu testified, then no, it's not inherently dangerous. And that's demonstrated by the history in this particular case. But you're talking about...
The driver is driving safely and is rear-ended or is jackknifed. The driver is driving safely, but the people are in the back and they're thrown out of the back of the truck.
So what you're talking about is risk, not probability as it relates to the specific facts of his case. I think that's an important distinction. So if you're talking about...
It seems to go to the probability of injury. To be exposed sitting in the back that way, not strapped up, no rails.
If you're talking about Mr. Gu and what he did or didn't do, and what he knew or didn't know. And I think, so what I'm hearing is really comments that are directed to the company and the company making policy. I mean, Mr. Gu is not an owner of this company. He's.
Well, isn't the supervisor responsible for safety of the his and her employees?
I think so, including...
Directly, aren't they?
I think so.
It's a big part of their responsibility, I would hope.
I agree. And just to reiterate, he wasn't the supervisor that day. He didn't assign Mr. Sumera to that truck that day.
I understand the facts. Thank you.
I see my time is up.
Yes, thank you. I'm so sorry. Okay, we will hear from Mr. Sonson. Thank you. I'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal. Thanks.
Good morning. Aloha. My name is Alex. There's really nothing wrong with our standard right now for Rule 56. It's had many years of use. The problem, however, that keeps popping up is really how trial judges and litigants approach the application of it. What we're looking at is a case today where the petitioner is seeking a change in the law where they can basically change the way that the judge should look at cases when the standard of or the burden of proof is different at trial. The case that's before us is a willful and wanton case. This is the Eddings versus Mei Li. The story goes that a psychiatric nurse was injured in a foreseeable incident. It's foreseeable and that the accident will occur, and it did occur, and she was injured. Co-employee, yes. A co-employee is the kind of, is a co-employee in this particular case, and similar to the Eddings case, is really an exception to the 386.5, which prohibits suit against the employer. co-employees are different, according to Eddings. And it's special because, you know, we don't open lawsuits and negligence, et cetera, against co-employees. So the court deemed that when a suit is brought, that the standard proof should be higher.
Right. So in this case, your client clearly had a workers' compensation claim against the company, and I imagine pursued it. But now you're seeking to hold your client's co-employee as individually liable because as an exception to the workers' comp. So the workers' comp is supposed to be a bargain between, right, the balance of a bargain between the employer not getting sued in tort, and but quick and sufficient compensation, hopefully under the workers' compensation statute. But there's this exception here where you're going after a co-employee because under the standard, there's a high, clear and convincing evidence that that individual did something to create a situation where injury was probable, right? So you're seeking that compensation as well, right? So now where we have this higher standard, Mr. Sansan, the question is, what don't you have to show that you will be able to prove, make that burden of proof at trial? You know, under like Ralston, I keep pointing to Ralston, you have to show, right? You have to show, even at the summary, why should you get to go to trial if at the summary judgment stage, the evidence clearly doesn't establish that probability? So we're just talking about the standard right now, okay? Not the evidence. Yeah.
Understood, Your Honor. Yes, the plaintiff has to prove it at trial.
Yes.
But the plaintiff should not have to prove it at the summary judgment proceedings.
Okay, well, in this case, discovery was closed already, right?
Yes.
By the time SJ was filed and the SJ ruling was entered. So there wasn't any more evidence that was going to be gathered in this case. I understand there's a difference when there's still discovery to be had. That was what was happening in Ralston. Here, all the discovery was piled. All of the evidence that you would have had to go to trial with, you had at the summary judgment stage, right?
Yes, the evidence was there, and the ICA looked at the evidence in deciding or making their decision that says that the trial judge erred in the way he decided his case. And the reason for that is the trial judge sought a mini trial during summary judgment, which is not allowed. What the question is, the important question in the summary judgment proceeding is whether a reasonable fact finder of a jury can look at the evidence and see whether or not there's evidence that's for the jury only.
Wait, counsel, I mean, yeah. Doesn't Rodriguez and Beamer suggest that the applicable standard of proof should also be considered when the court is looking at the evidence? How do you get around those two cases?
Yeah, Rodriguez versus Nishiki and Beamer versus Nishiki, 82 and 83 cases that this court heard. Those are defamation cases. They actually said that in the...
That also involve higher standards.
Yes.
Why shouldn't we apply that in this situation that also has higher standards involved?
The way that the same kind of trial standard at Lynn Beamer and also with Rodriguez, it's also clear and convincing because they were dealing with a defamation case, and they said that the particular element of malice had to be clearly convincing. The rest of it was okay to be under preponderance of it. But the point is, it's really not important to make any changes on our Rule 56 rule. It's just, again, how the judges apply it. And they apply, whether it's clear and convincing or general negligence or even intentional, it is really the process that went wrong. If you take a situation such as in Rodriguez, such as in Beamer, such as in Sumera, the judges will know, okay, the trial evidence, the trial burden will be clear and convincing. It's a higher burden. But you cannot apply that during the time that you're looking at evidence at the summary Isn't
this a special situation? I mean, the ledge, you know, passed 386-8 to protect co-employees from tort liability. Ittings then fleshed that out, provided a standard, and it seems like what you're asking us to do is to strip that standard of summary judgment and from this particular unique situation of co-employment, you know, torts, and doesn't that undermine the legislature's policy and the legislative intent here? Isn't this an exception just like the First Amendment situation?
Respectfully, it's a little bit different in a way. What the legislature had implemented is really an exception, and that's correct. But they also made it special, I guess, because it's special because it's make it harder to prove. It's basically, again, it's very important that we have a bar to suing the employer. The contract has been made with employers and manufacturers.
Yeah, harder to sue, but what you want to do is to strip that added protection. And why shouldn't the court, when it is evaluating what proof is actually required to overcome the Rule 56 stage, be able to use what the legislature intended?
The protection for co-employees is at the trial level. What they're seeking to do and what I'm resisting is that they change it the way the judges apply it during summary judgment. The case that they are relying on developed. One of the cases they're relying on is Anderson versus Liberty Lobby. That case is also a defamation case. But in that particular case, they did develop a coherent standard. I say this because if this court are going to look at Bremer and say, we are going to make changes, we're going to analyze it, and we're going to overrule it, I don't think there's any need to do that at all. But let me tell you first about what Anderson is saying. Anderson is saying that during the summary judgment Rule 56 motion, the judge should take a look at the trial standard of the burden of proof, okay? But you don't use that to look at every evidence put forth by the parties and assess the quality or the credibility
I think we understand the Anderson majority and the Brennan and Rehnquist strange bedfellows on the dissent there. So aside from Anderson, and again, a First Amendment context, so that it's a unique situation, First Amendment, isn't this also a unique situation?
Yes, it is. It is a unique situation that the legislators deemed it necessary to have this exception to 386-5, 386-K is a lawsuit that's possible against co-employees when the conduct rises to willful and wanton, and in order to prove that, you must carry a higher burden. Yes,
that
it is a special.
That higher burden was imposed by this court, not by the legislature.
Then I stand corrected, Your Honor. This court in Eddings did set up two ways to prove willful and wanton. The first is the intentional portion of it, showing that two ways, motivated by an actual intent to cause an injury, that is not before us. The second one is the committed in circumstance indicating that the injury of the employee, and then it goes to a three-prong test. It deals with the knowledge of the perpetrator or the person that's causing misconduct, in this case, Mr. Gu, that he has the knowledge of the peril to be apprehended. In this particular case, the petitioners did not contest that part at the ICA, so that is a given. So the next prong is whether Mr. Gu had knowledge that the injury is probable as opposed to a possible result of danger. And again, that's dealt with by the evidence presented by the parties. When the judge's justice looked at the evidence put forth by the appellant, in this case, Mr. Sumera, they found that Mr. Gu had the knowledge that injury was probable in this case. Falling off a truck is the danger to be averted.
Mr. Sunstein,
yes.
The argument by Mr. Valencia is that compared to Iddings, where there were, in fact, various injuries or incidents at the Castle Hospital before the incident there, where furniture was, you know, crowded together, that people had fallen, et cetera. There were prior incidents that indicated that this was an unsafe situation. How do you compare this case? What is the evidence that you're pointing to on this question that Mr. Gu acted in a willful and wanton manner such that he knew injury was probable?
The Iddings case looked at evidence in that case showing or alleging to show that there were prior incidents. But prior incidents is not needed. It's not necessary for the prong B to take place.
What do you rely on for that? What authority do you rely on for that statement?
The ICA has pointed out, and I repeat, the evidence that put forth by Mr. Mara in this case is that Mr. Gu actually said that he is aware, first, he's aware of the peril of falling off a truck, in that he is aware that if an erratic driver or a driver with speed up to 25 miles an hour and press on the brake, which is foreseeable, that the employees in the back of the truck, an unprotected truck, would fall. He suggested that, it's okay because I tell the driver that, you know, you got to be careful.
So, you're supposed to drive like 25 miles an hour or something like that, right? Is that what the evidence says?
I understand that most of our roads are 25 miles per hour, but the facts of this case was that they were actually assembling it in a park, and then they have to drive to the street where they have to distribute the garbage bins.
Okay. So just to go back to my question, you're relying on Mr. Gu's deposition testimony where he was asked about that hypothetical.
We rely on that, and there was also a testimony by Mr. Sumera that he actually had a knowledge of a prior incident. That was not well developed, but that's for the jury to look at anyway.
I'm not sure that was admissible. I don't know if Mr. Sumera had personal knowledge of that. But you're relying on his declaration.
They were, right? Also relying on his declaration, and also relying on the declaration of Mr. Lechtowen, who was the supervisor for that day. But it's not because Mr. Gu was present or not present there. The mechanism of injury in this case is actually the plan that which he initiated. The plan is, let's make a lot of money. Let's deliver as fast as we can. Open truck. You guys, two guys sit over here. You drive. And you just go to the street. And two guys were running behind there, grabbing garbage cans, and off they go.
Right. I think we understand the circumstances. Is it clear that Mr. Gu had the say as to how these bins would be? Did he have the final say in terms of how these bins would be delivered?
Yes, Your Honor. He actually implemented this plan. He is the head dude. The supervisor, but it's actually a special contract for the city. It is not something that the ordinary that RHM usually do. This is a project where we were going into green, and then, you know, there's green and blue garbage cans. Somebody took that contract, and it was RHM. But the way that they could make a lot of money in this, and this is a special crew, mm-hmm. that they put together, that Mr. Gu put together. And he said, this is what we are going to do. And he admitted that in his deposition. He took credit for that.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, you know, the workers' compensation scheme is set up so that the employer gets immunity, because no matter how the employee gets hurt, short of intention or being drunk on the job, they get coverage, even if it's their fault, right? And then you go after a co-employee. Doesn't that bring in the employer's insurance anyway? Don't you kind of backdoor the employer in? And then there they are having to defend this. Why shouldn't the quantum of proof be considered as a special situation or circumstances here in these types of cases?
To be honest, in practice, because of the way that this law is set up, or the way that the Iddings has set up, it's really even not worth it to go after co-employees unless there is coverage. That's usually the impediment, and that could be something that would bar.
But that just kind of backdoors the employer into the case, doesn't it?
It will never be the. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm sorry. The employer is never implicated in a co-employee liability type of situation.
Well, financially, they're implicated, though.
I beg to disagree, Your Honor. They are not financially implicated at all, because most times the co-employee, it depends who or she is in a position. They're being sued individually.
So what is that, homeowners?
Who's covering? It's possible. It's possible. I don't know who pays. All I know is that this law says let's allow co-employees to sue co-employees who are willful and wanton. This is to prevent accidents.
I understand your position. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anything else?
Yes, I see I got it right when they said, I know this footnote was something that grabbed attention. In the footnote in page 6, this is a footnote 4, we note that the circuit court applied an incorrect standard in considering at the summary judgment stage whether Somera would be able to produce clear and convincing evidence of Gu's alleged willful and wanton misconduct. That is not an untrue statement, and that is something to be defended. It really depends on how you read Bremer. Bremer can be read narrowly to fit the situation, really, to say that, because Bremer deals with assessing. That's weighing the evidence, which was discussed earlier. The trial judges should not weigh the evidence at all. That's not their job. And that's what
can you address Justice Ginoza's point that, the trial court under Ralston considers whether the non-movement will be unable to carry his burden of proof at trial, and when considering that, why shouldn't that trial court consider the burden of proof that's actually going to be required? Isn't that what Ralston said?
I confess that I've not read that case, but what I've heard today regarding what it's saying and what you're saying, Your Honor, is that whether or not that Ralston requires the trial judge at summary judgment proceeding to actually look at the evidence, whether or not the quality of it can pass. I think that goes beyond the scope, the work that the trial judge has to do in a summary judgment proceeding. Their job is to take a look at, to actually just look at the evidence, make inferences in favor of non-moving party, and then apply the good old standards. It really even doesn't matter what the standard proof is. It's just the way that they apply it. And that's what happened in...
Well, how do you apply it if you don't really know how to evaluate what the non-movement, has to mean?
But that's the thing, Your Honor. Trial judge should not evaluate the quality of the evidence being put forth in summary judgment. That is reserved for the finders of fact, a jury, a reasonable jury. So the question is really, can, after looking at the evidence, sorting it out, the judge will ask the question, can a reasonable jury, given all the benefit of doubt, can they believe this and say, oh yeah, Mr. Gu, Mr. Gu, the elements of the probability is satisfied, and the element of recklessness, of consciously disregarding the peril, is satisfied. That's for it from Eddings until now. That should always be the purview of the jury and not the trial judge. The trial judge can identify what evidence exists. Trial judge can determine whether the evidence, if believed by a jury, could satisfy the legal elements, and determine whether the dispute is genuine, and determine whether the fact is material or legally sufficient. That's it. The judge should not and may not decide what the credibility of the witnesses, what they're talking about, should not compare this side or the other evidence, the quality of evidence from each side. So if the trial judge stay within their lane and reserve questions of fact, genuine material fact, for the jury, the way that the standards are set up right now is okay as it is. There's no need to revisit Bremer. There's no need to adopt Anderson. And again, as the court is indicated, this court looked at Rodriguez, this court looked at Beamer. Those are special cases that dealing with First Amendment rights. I got nothing else other than to say,
I have a question, though.
Oh, okay. Then I have time. Okay.
Yeah, almost there.
Okay.
So, you know, in the ICA, they affirmed the summary judgment with regards to IIED, finding that there was no outrageous conduct based on this very same record, and yet there was no. You did not file a petition seeking review of that. Right?
No, Your Honor.
I mean, the argument has been made, isn't that a weighing or at least a looking at whether the evidence stacks up to outrageousness? Why is that different than looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to your client and whether it stacks up to being able to prove by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Gu, you know, his actions what led to a probable injury. You know what I mean? How is that different with regards to IIED versus this workers' comp exception? You get my question? You didn't challenge that part of the, you didn't challenge the SD, the
yes,
SDO with
regards and to I, that. And I cannot respond to your question since I didn't challenge it. Begging your pardon, Your Honor, but I did not specifically looked at that for today because that was not part of the things that we were concerned of and we did not appeal that portion.
I'm just trying to understand how your arguments align today if you don't similarly challenge that, but okay, no response to that.
No response.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sansan. Thank you.
I mean, I understand your argument about the trial judge weighing evidence and just the fact that a trial judge had one opinion and then the ICA had a different opinion. It troubles me that different judges could have different opinions, which tells me that there might be a genuine issue of material fact. But for the willful and wanton, doesn't it really turn on the knowledge of Mr. Gu and whether he consciously failed to avoid the peril? So it turns on what he knew and his actions, and that's something that raises, like other justices have discussed, whether his knowledge is something that the jury should decide. Is that something that a judge should be deciding?
No, Your Honor. The knowledge or the state of mind of Mr. Gu should not be decided by the judge. That's a fact-finding matter which is reserved for the jury. It's a question of fact, what he has in his mind. And as far as proof, as proof as to what is in his mind, we cannot have him confess. And if he does, as in this case, we can take a look at something he said in a deposition. And I think that's what the ICA might look at. Because a deposition, a question was asked, and the way he answered, it's taken like an admission. So the quality, though, of the evidence that's put forth to prove each of the prongs of Eddings, it's all fact finding that's reserved again for the jury. So if there's a question as to the probability of injury, the jury will have to deal with that. All in summary judgment, the judge at sitting there in the proceeding just have to look at whether there is any evidence put forth at all, and then take a look at that and go through the steps. But never weigh it, never judge it, never assess it. Always, it's a reserved assessment, weighing for the fact finder.
Thank you.
All right, anything else? Thank you very much, Mr. Sansan. A few minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Valencia.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'll try and talk as fast as I can. I have just a few points I want to make. I want to read an excerpt from Rodriguez v. Nishiki, which we cited on page 7 of our application. Conversely, the trial court must deny the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment in an actual malice defamation action if a reasonable trier of fact could find that there was no clear and convincing proof of defendant's actual malice, viewing all the evidence and reasonable inferences therefrom in the light most favorable to the defendant as the non-movant. That is completely inconsistent with Bremer. This is a decision that's on the books, that's good law. This is the standard we're asking you to adopt and clarify. That you've basically you've already
Rodriguez,
adopted.
I can't remember. Did we cite to any United States Supreme Court cases?
No, no, Your Honor, you didn't.
Okay.
So the Beamer case as well on page 7, same result. Those were defamation cases. But on page 8, Ueda v. Shermer, 144 Hawaii 163.
But would you agree that in the defamation cases, actually reviewing that standard is actually required by SCOTUS's First Amendment jurisprudence? In other words, we have to follow what the minimum of what United States Supreme Court says with respect to defamation, right? SCOTUS has said that you have to evaluate based on the clear and convincing for First Amendment defamation cases, right?
At trial, yes.
Yes.
They didn't say for summary judgment that they're imposing a mandate on state courts to do. They can't do that, I think, procedurally.
I see. Thank you.
You're welcome, Your Honor.
Good point. Thank you.
Regarding Ueda, on page 8, that is not a defamation case where you apply the same standard.
But that was a case in which the district court actually granted summary judgment in favor of a petitioner, finding that there was clear and convincing evidence. And this court held that there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether or not there was clear and convincing evidence. So it does not seem, it's a little different situation.
Well, I cite it because this court
held that it was improper to grant SJ finding clear based on clear and convincing evidence. We remanded for trial.
I think because the evidence wasn't sufficient, but the standard was still applied.
Wait. Yeah. You know, Ueda, the clear and convincing language addressed the injunction.
Mm-hmm.
That's
correct.
Not the summary judgment.
Well, the injunction was a part of the summary judgment. That's the whole case. I mean, the summary judgment on the whole case, which included the injunction, which required proof by clear and convincing evidence. And the standard...
No, but there were two different issues. The clear and convincing evidence related to the injunction that was on the restraining order case, and then the court, you know, granted the summary judgment on a different issue, not the injunction. And by the way, I was the lawyer in
Ueda. Right.
In the trial court level.
I'm going to defer to you, Justice. On that. you know, I do want to address the fact that this is de novo review, so we don't believe this should be sent back. There, I really want to just talk a little bit about the evidence, because we've been talking primarily in general terms. The three pieces of evidence that the court relied on were the Lactoan declaration, where he said that Mr. Gu told him at some undetermined point in the past that guardrails would cost more. What does that mean? That doesn't provide evidence of the three-prong test that you established. The Sumera declaration, that I really want to mention this, okay? His declaration, as Justice Ginoza pointed out, conflicts with his deposition testimony. And we cited in our brief the sham affidavit rule. And I would ask you respectfully to adopt formally the sham affidavit rule for litigants in the trenches like me, where a litigant's declaration conflicts with deposition testimony in opposition to a summary judgment motion. I mean, you cited the sham affidavit rule before, but I would ask you to officially adopt it and apply it in this case. So Sumera, in his declaration, says that several people told Mr. Gu about prior accidents. That conflicts with his deposition testimony, where he said, I've never even talked to Mr. Gu. No one's ever told me about any complaints. The last piece of evidence that the ICA relied on was the hypothetical question to Mr. Gu. It's a hypothetical question.
Did Mr. Gu say that he had spoken with this person?
No, Mr. Gu testified that he never received any complaints about safety or anyone falling off the truck.
Yes.
Mr. Sumera said the same things. And Mr. Sumera, in his deposition, said he never even talked to Gu, and no one ever told him about complaints. That's what he said in his deposition. In the declaration, he said three people complained to Mr. Gu about falling off the truck.
And that was hearsay.
It was hearsay, and it's also, I think, implicates the sham affidavit rule. That's where, where I'm asking you to adopt that rule. And so regarding the hypothetical for Mr. Gu, it doesn't even comport with the facts of this case, where someone is speeding up and slamming on the brakes and someone falls off. That's not even what happened here. So I don't think that hypothetical question is enough to satisfy the three-part test. They're basically treating Mr. Gu like the owner of the company. The remedy here is against the company through the workers' comp system, which he got. So I'm asking you to follow your decision, or clarify Bremer, follow your prior decisions that do use the clear and convincing evidence standard. I think the circuit court got it right. And just one final point on Justice Ginoza's point about IIED. The circuit court took away that issue from the jury. So did the ICA. This is no different. We're asking you to do the same thing here. I don't think it's any different procedurally than what happened with the intentional infliction claim. So I would ask you to apply this exception with great caution to comport with the legislative intent and clarify your decision in Bremer.
All right, thank you very much. This court will take this matter under advisement.
Eku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'o malolo ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki ike hanahano. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.